From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour will be made in a single afternoon, this coming Friday, just a few hours to find out what poverty feels like, how frustrating it can be. Friday, we'll bring the third poverty simulation this year with the goal of helping people better understand the kinds of challenges that families in poverty face. If you want to solve poverty, the idea goes, shouldn't we try to understand it first? Now, the simulation won't offer a perfect look at what poverty is like. That can't happen in a morning or an afternoon or even a week, but it can offer participants a glimpse of poverty, of the pain of trying to get work without a car, or juggling childcare and daycare, as we talked about last hour, or understanding how to apply for help. Poverty remains a massive, deep problem in Rochester. We know from recent studies that Rochester has the most extreme poverty of any city of its size in the country. We know that Rochester has more children living in poverty than children living not in poverty. Last hour, we focused on the impact of childcare, particularly on parents and families trying to escape poverty and low-income situations. That discussion continues now, and we invite more of your phone calls. We're going to broaden the discussion to look at upcoming anti-poverty efforts. My guests for the hour are closely involved with a new anti-poverty initiative. They're Fran Weisberg, a president and CEO of the United Way of Greater Rochester, and so nice to have Fran in studio. Thank you, Fran.
Thank you so much.
Also here is Dawn Borghese, the Senior Vice President and Corporate Affairs Officer. And Dawn, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Dawn, this is, my understanding, the third poverty simulation coming up on Friday.
Yes.
And like we said, a poverty simulation doesn't give a participant a perfect view of poverty. Can't quite get there. But what can it do?
I would say that the most fundamental thing it does is really just help increase empathy and have people understand the system, if you will, or the lack thereof. So just to give them some real insight into what is it like? What are the true challenges and unexpected things? Often people will walk away and say, I never realized it would be so much work and how much energy it takes and how difficult it is when you suddenly are in that system. Mm-hmm. Trying to understand how to get from point A to point B becomes almost feels insurmountable to people.
And what are some of the reasons why? What are some of the examples that we might see simulated Friday but become those day-to-day struggles that, frankly, folks like myself, many of our listening audience, might not be thinking about?
I think just I know that in preparation there are staff that have been asked to play roles. Mm-hmm. So it also, for instance, often we assume that we know exactly what the face of poverty looks. Some of the people that are actually going to be doing some of the work are not making a livable wage. They have been frustrated. They understand the rules that are guiding their work don't necessarily make any more sense to them than they do the people that they're administering the program to, so to speak. So it, I think, helps from both sides for people to suddenly understand, eyes wide open. And I think what we're excited about is one of the what makes this very different is in the poverty initiative, mm-hmm. the state has committed to work with us on really starting to address some of these systemic policies that over the years have layered on top of one another in counterintuitive ways. So this simulation very much starts pointing that out. You begin to understand almost how outright silly some of the rules are. And I think we just had someone this morning share that they participated in the last session. They ended up saying, I stole something from the pawn shop and restole it because I needed to get food on the table for my kid, and I'll do whatever it takes. Mm. So she was kind of stunned at herself, saying, I didn't think I'd do that, but I suddenly felt like I started thinking about how do I get what I need and kind of ignoring some of the rules.
In other words, for those of us not in poverty, it's easy to judge and say, well, why would people steal? Why would anybody try to do a quick cash grab at a store, things like that? Mm-hmm. Put yourself in a position where mm-hmm. you cannot buy groceries for your family.
Right.
And that doesn't, I'm not saying that justifies, but mm-hmm. Fran?
Well, just there's other examples I heard about, which is it's 6:45 in the morning and your car doesn't start and it's -2 degrees. This happened a lot this past winter. You got two little kids and not a lot of money and no family around to help. Those are the kind of examples. We pick up the phone, you call somebody else, or you call somebody and say, AAA, and say, come help me fix it. That's not everybody has that.
Not only people don't have AAA, some families have to find a way to try to get to meetings, appointments, et cetera, without a car, right?
Bingo. That's one of the top issues that people, just simple transportation, to a food store or to work.
Now, the other thing we're excited about, what makes this session unique, is because of our strong partnership with the state, we have over 20 commissioners coming from Albany to take part in this as well. So they're very excited mm-hmm. about it. They're anxious to understand as well. And so it'll be, as I said, we already actually have people waitlisted to participate. But we're very excited that it's also a different mix of people who already bring in a certain view. So I think it's going to be fascinating to
yes.
talk with those people at the end of the afternoon to say, what was the biggest surprise to you? Because in some cases, mm-hmm. these commissioners, you know, they're trying to help people. And I think it will be kind of transformational to say, we thought we were doing A, but you can't get to A from where I sat.
But I think what's most important, if we could for a minute step back and say why we're doing all of this, it really is. And what is transformational, I think, is that the community is truly coming together, whether it's the mayor, the county executive, majority leader, the governor, all the foundations, people in poverty, the religious community, to say, wow, we have some statistics that people that I talk to say they're ashamed. They're ashamed that Rochester has the second highest child poverty rate. The first, number one in extreme poverty rate in our nation. When people read the report that was done about poverty, I think people were shocked and say, we really need to do something this time. Community, let's get together and do something.
I think one of the reasons that report has resonated is because it did not compare apples to oranges. It compared apples to apples. Rochester
right.
and cities of similar sizes
exactly.
across the country, I think 18 or 19 cities. And
yes.
as you just heard Fran mention, Rochester, number one in extreme poverty. That number is people living at 50% or below mm-hmm. of the poverty line. And so I, if I'm remembering correctly, Rochester had around a 36% poverty rate, but around half of that was extreme poverty. I mean, that's... Mm-hmm. One in six or so in extreme poverty.
Yeah,
it's
we could
amazing.
Go. Yeah, I mean, 52% of children in the city live in poverty, more than double the national average. There are so many different statistics. I encourage everybody to read Ed Doherty's poverty report. It's very shocking. The question for all of us in this community is, what do we do about it? And I'm very thrilled that there is the Rochester Monroe County Anti-Poverty Initiative that has come together. I'm also very, we're very honored that United Way has been asked to coordinate and convene just to provide an infrastructure to everybody coming together and working together. This will be a thoughtful, planful, data and analytics kind of approach to this. But you know what's the most important? I am feeling like the whole community is committing to having a plan that's coordinated, aligned, one plan. And as Dawn keeps saying, go back to Albany. Here's some of the short-term, medium-term, and long-term solutions that we've all agreed to as a community. Now, New York State, break down your silos, you know, your silly rules. They're not their silly rules. They're hundreds of years probably of silly rules. And let's look at what makes most sense for the individual. Put the person in the center. A better coordination of services than what this initiative promises. We will come up with evidence-based solutions. We will then have measures, and we will track and report back to the community throughout this whole process. We promise.
If you want to call the program, I'd love to hear from listeners on tackling poverty is such a deep and
huge,
intractable
huge.
Issue. And we're going to be talking this hour about what might make this effort different, because as ambitious as this effort is, it's not the first anti-poverty effort.
No.
And so, but I want to hear from you about some of the challenges that maybe create those kind of barriers to solving poverty, whether it's jobs or other things. Call the program. It's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. A number of you have already written in. We're going to get to some of your written comments coming up here. And again, our guests for the hour from the United Way, Fran Weisberg and Dawn Borgeist, were on Friday afternoon. We've got the third poverty simulation coming up. Dawn, you mentioned there are some commissioners coming from Albany, but what kind of people coming from Albany? What kind of background they're coming in, I guess, to learn about this? But you mentioned the term commissioners. So give me a sense for who's
well,
coming.
In other words, they under the leadership of Fran Barrett, who has been appointed by the governor to work with our team here in the community. So it's the various commissioners in Albany. So of
so they run agencies, the Department of Transportation, right? Temporary assistance, transportation, the different agents, the Department of Health. These are the different agencies. Department of Labor, the State Office for Aging, all the different agencies that actually provide the services, work with our county and our city, and various human service agencies that will really be here and have the power to really help build solutions, break down barriers and silos.
Megan in Rochester, you're up first. Go ahead, Megan.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm wondering about the initiative and if you are working with the Rochester City School District on policies that they have for admissions to schools, and if there's a way to look at how we can break up poverty in our high-needs schools.
Megan, stay on the line. Let's get an answer from Dawn and Fran. Go ahead, Dawn.
We absolutely have representatives actually in a variety of places. We have folks on the steering committee from the district. We actually have one of our co-chairs in the education work group. We have six work groups, Del Bavard out of the district. We also have charter schools represented. We also have parents represented. We have the union represented. Tom Gillette's going to be committing his time. So we have really all different aspects. So I suspect that that will be coming up, that kind of topic. And the work groups also will be holding briefings so that once they get their initial kind of draft thoughts together, they will be open, hosting a very open forum so that folks like yourself, Megan, could come and listen so that if there's something that someone feels they have neglected to address, it's an opportunity to say, hey, what about this? This is important to me.
Okay.
Megan, you're—I assume you're a Rochester City School District parent.
I am. I'm a parent of three, and I'm very interested in socioeconomic integration and the managed school choice policy that the district has. And it seems like if we want to integrate our schools, what we need to do is provide a better policy for our school district so that middle-income families can enroll their students in schools and not have to worry about every school being a high-poverty school. So it seems like better public policy, better education policy would be a natural place to start to help break up the poverty in our city.
But I bet Dawn and I would be answering the same way. You have just, you're spot on. That's why working with the state and the feds are so critical to this. If we can come up with solutions with parents and content experts and government and community and people living in poverty to say, this is what we think makes sense. The public policy side of this is going to be critical. We drive to Albany. We say, break down this barrier, change this policy, waive this rule.
Right. Well, we're running out of time. So if you want to meet tomorrow, let
me
know.
I hear you.
But Megan, Megan, I do want to ask you something as a parent, because you just brought up the notion of, you said you want middle-income families to, how did you phrase it? You want them to feel like...
Well, I want them to know that if they invest in the district and in the schools, that they don't have to have this concern that every school they apply to is going to be a high-poverty school. If we have a better policy to make more balanced schools. You hear a lot about the 60-40 balance that we need.
Mm-hmm.
There's
the
a way to do that within, you know, the policy with the district.
Okay, because what came to mind for me, and maybe it's only because we've had a number of conversations in the last year on this program about it. You know, a Rochester group went down to Wake County, North Carolina, and they studied the school system there that integrated countywide in 1975 or six, and they have rules that say no school can be more than 40% free or reduced lunch.
Correct.
That ends up being, though, a situation where a lot of students end up, and this is not a negative, this is an observation, they accept the fact that there's going to be some students bust a little farther because sometimes they have got to reshuffle the decks. I don't know, Megan, if that's sort of what you're getting at for Rochester, or if there are other ways to achieve that kind of situation.
Well, my concern is that we're missing families that already do live in the city. They already are sending their kids to schools. It's just that they're sending their kids to private schools and charter schools. And these are the middle-income families that
examples.
We need to be in our schools. And so if we can just be smarter about the way that we look at, you know, whether it's drawing boundaries for school choice or magnet schools, I don't believe that we necessarily need to go to a regional school or a metro system. I know a lot of people are leaning that way, but I believe we have to start with the middle-income families in the city that are integrating our schools, and there are schools that are seeing more success. But, you know, people keep talking about it, and we just need to find the parents who are going to send their kids to the schools to start to make this change.
Well, you are talking about a touchy issue for some parents who will say, hey, I want to send my kid to schools. I'd like to live in Rochester. I want to feel good about where I send them. And I'm not defending a parent's choice or decision one way or another. I'm simply saying, I think, Megan, a lot of parents will say you're absolutely right. Rochester schools will thrive when strong families are willing to send their kids there. And then the question is, you know, how do you move that needle?
Right. So you match the policy to create a system where we can have parents have that success by applying to a school where you could have up to 50 or 60% mm-hmm. middle-income families.
What a great phone call. Megan, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Megan. And go ahead, Dawn.
Megan, if you haven't already, if you could go to our website, the United Way Rochester website, there is a page that you can just give us your email and we will send you updates that go out every 2 weeks. So anyone that's listening that's interested, we'd strongly encourage you. We have hundreds of people already, but we need as many people in this conversation involved, parents like Megan, critical to the conversation for us. So Megan, if you would do that, that'd be fabulous.
And come to one of the town meetings, because I think you're bringing up one of the fundamental issues before us, which is the concentration of poverty,
yes.
Whether it's in housing, whether it's in schools. So however we can do that, all of the data suggests that if you don't have it be wherever all poverty is concentrated, whether it's in your school or in a neighborhood, that's what causes a lot of problems.
It's 1:22. I'm looking at the clock, and I'm already thinking, I'm not going to get through everything I wanted to talk about. Megan's phone call got me thinking about so many different things here.
We'll come back.
With Dawn Borghese and Fran Weisberg from the United Way as we talk about the new anti-poverty initiative. But let me say again, if you want to join the conversation, that's what this program's about, a community discussion. If you want to call, it's 844-295-TALK. 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Fran, you essentially said that there is a goal to figure out what sort of is working, what is not, mm-hmm. and be willing to go to Albany and say, we got to take this barrier down, we have to make these changes. Let me be totally hypothetical here, because mm-hmm. Megan is talking about, from a parent's perspective, how do we get more middle-income families to be willing mm-hmm. to send their kids to Rochester schools, to be part of the discussion? How do we achieve better schools, more balance, all of those things? But here's just an experiment. I'm not saying this is going to happen, but what happens if the Anti-Poverty Initiative decides, hey, that Wake County thing is a wonderful model. It is working pretty well. The difference, though, Wake County had an urban district and a suburban mm-hmm. district, two districts. Monroe County has 19. I don't think you're going to convince 18 districts to be willing to adopt that radical solution. I guess, in other mm-hmm. words, I'm saying, what if the Anti-Poverty Initiative uncovers some possible changes, but it's going to take a lot of political right. will to move it? I don't know how you get there.
Well, you're going to think I'm not answering your question, but I think I am. But I want to start with, we're going to crawl, then we're going to walk, then we're going to run. I think what you need to know is what's very dynamic here is we have these several work groups, 25 people in a work group that also works with a system design group that's, again, a community-wide group of people working with a steering committee and some political leadership. We're going to start with looking at what is the problem. I don't even want to jump to solutions yet. We have a lot of people, smart people and people that care and people that know the problem, sitting together in a room. It's going to be in a thoughtful, planned way that we're going to come up with also short-term, medium-term, and long-term solutions. I don't honestly know what's going to come out. And we're going to make priorities of what's most important when. We're then going to probably not start with, let's have one countywide school district, I would suspect. I could
sure.
be wrong.
No, I understand.
But let's say that people also say, we need to break down these barriers to have, I don't know, how to disperse poverty or, you know, home visitation or certain kinds of, what are some low-hanging fruit, all the way to big policies. Give us a chance. What I want to do is have these work groups really start going, look and see what's there. I think one of the criteria we need to say is what's possible and what are your dreams? Because the thing the governor does want is that we say we have as a goal to eliminate childhood poverty. That's very aspirational, but I think we should all go there, whether that's in 10 years or 15 years. What's the first three steps?
And as you mentioned, eliminating childhood poverty in a city with the second highest childhood poverty rate in the country for city its size, 51, 52%. So more children in the city than not living in poverty.
So how do we start moving the needle? That's what our real goal is.
It's amazing.
And it's going to take some time. That's the one thing we're all clear about as well. But I think we're confident we're going to do it step by step.
Now, here is, before I get to more of your comments, and again, I appreciate them online as well. We're going to get to more of those. But you also heard Fran mention all the different people involved. Let me just kind of quickly read part of the roster. I'm not even sure this is all of the roster. And some of our listeners might think, wow, this is amazing. Look at that lineup. And some might think, that is a lot of cooks in the kitchen. And if one cook wants oregano and one wants cinnamon and one wants no salt, how do you convince all of these strong players to do that? Listen to these people. Jim Bertolone is a labor leader. Don Braveman, president of Nazareth College. Maggie Brooks, Monroe County executive. Holly Budd is the executive director of the Farish Foundation. Peter Carpino, Fran Weisberg, Dawn Borghese, from United Way, Anne Marie Cook, Agency of Council Executives, Bill Dessler from RIT, Bob Duffy from RBA, Ed Doherty, of course, from the Rochester Area Community Foundation, who helped write that report, Ann Kress from MCC, Jennifer Leonard from the Community Foundation. I'm barely even getting through, I think, half. Colgate Divinity's Marvin McMickle, Larry Marks from the Children's Agenda, who was here last hour, Joe Morelli, State Assemblyman. I mean, it goes on and on. Bolhan Vargas from the City School District, Lovely Warren, the mayor, Danny Wegman. Wow. I mean, and that's not all of them. That's a lot of towering figures in this community who will eventually have to agree. And I don't know how you get everybody on the same page.
Well, and I'll let Don talk to the process of the work groups. But actually, I will do this. It is going to be a very facilitated process with experts that know how to bring consensus in a work group. It then goes to the systems group and a steering committee, who I'm sure will be vetting the final kind of recommendations that we have. But again, I'm going to say, if we don't do it that way and we don't come together and come up with solutions, this is going to be, I think, a very well done process. I implore us to make it work, because what we have been doing, everybody has ideas. It's been a very fragmented approach. It's not been one community coming together. I think that we have to, and I believe that we can. But Dawn, talk a little bit about the work groups.
And I actually want to me, the work groups have two critical bookends. The group that you mentioned, Evan, is actually the steering committee,
which is
kind of like the board of directors.
Of course.
They're not our subject matter experts, with all due respect, although many of them have some great ideas.
Absolutely. No, I think that's a great point.
But equally important to me, while we have the simulation, which we talked about on Friday, which gives you some empathy, one of the other most critical pieces is that we are right now in the field with professional market researchers who are doing one-on-one interviews with people living in poverty. Those are absolutely critical conversations, because we're looking for threads, we're looking for a deep understanding. Everything we find there, we're meeting with, we're talking, probably our goal is between 30 to 45 people living in poverty. And another 20 or so people who literally have unique positions where they work with people in poverty and have a very unique purview into the system of poverty. Family court justices, teachers, and social workers. So we're also talking with them. They are, all of them have been identified as working with high concentration of poverty clients. So we're going to take those two learnings and feed those to these work groups. These work groups, there's a total of six of them, right, in the various areas: education, workforce development, justice, health and nutrition, safe neighborhoods, and housing. So they each have co-chairs. They are just finishing up selecting work groups. We're hoping to be able to announce those work groups next week. What's also unique, however, is those work groups are, they have had to commit, which to me, this is amazing. So you got 25 people per work group times six. They have all committed to 2 full days of a facilitated session. So many of these are subject matter experts. They are consumers, people living in poverty. They are people who are invested in this community. They are being facilitated by trained facilitators who also have a template, if you will, that the System Design Committee is a group that's going to do all the integration and prioritization. They've asked, don't just give us kind of your thoughts in whatever format you'd like. It's, here's how we need your recommendations coming to us. And it includes things like, here's our recommendations, here's the data to support what we believe is going to work, our top four. So they're going to have to arm wrestle in those meetings with the facilitator. What are the barriers that they're seeing? What resources do they need to make this achievable? So a lot of, I mean, your first reaction is very natural, Evan. It's kind of like, how would we ever get to there? In some ways, that's what this group is going to have to literally arm wrestle for 48 hours to come up with their recommendations, so that as a group collectively, here's our best thinking on our area in the four top recommendations. Those then come to system design. They merge, prioritize. We'll be doing community briefings, so the community will be able to get a look at that. We're also going to be going back out, oh, by the way, to talk to people living in poverty. Yes. Because often we think we've got this brilliant mousetrap built. We want to then sit back down with those same people to say, if we change this from this to this, what have we missed? Does that work? Does it address what we thought we heard you tell us about what the challenges are? And then ultimately it rolls to that steering committee for really kind of the final review and what I would say is really then the firepower, right? They're going to say, okay, now we're going to go to the state with this. Now we've got a plan that we can have the next conversation, which is how do we implement this?
It does sound very big and very daunting, but two things. First of all, people are committing so many hours and so much time in this because they do believe in this. They believe in this process. And from the governor to all of his staff, they are right there with us and have a partnership. It's part of his 10-point opportunity agenda. It's very exciting. And I also will say, we've done this before in this community. When I worked at the Finger Lakes Health Systems Agencies, we did bring all of the stakeholders together to drive health improvement as a community. And the reason why sometimes when it got very tense and very difficult, it was the state of New York that said, why don't you sit at that table? We don't want to keep building beds unnecessarily. We want people to come together and improve health and do prevention. This is the same concept and the same model. So we all need, there's a carrot and stick, there's a lot of passion, and we have very, very sad, bad statistics here.
Well, the one area that I think is instantly a benefit to getting this many people and agencies involved is sometimes there are great intentions, but the right hand may not know what the left hand is doing. Ooh. And in this case, it's almost like you will have no stone unturned. You've got so many people, so many agencies together that at the very least, you're going to have people in the room saying, I never knew that this was the case, or I didn't realize that we could be doing X, Y, Z together. So I think at the very least, you'll have that opportunity. But Craig writes to the program, great lineup of people in power to eliminate poverty. Yeah. Too bad there aren't any people who are in poverty to say what is keeping them there. We seem to do a lot of talking among people of means and telling poor people how to solve their problems. I don't think money is the answer. But Craig, as we just established, they are working very directly with people in poverty, as you said. Right, Dawn?
There are at least, our target is to have at least five people living in poverty on each of those work groups. So they are part of, and that's really at the end of the day where the solution thinking is occurring, as well as getting the consumer insights from the market researcher. I should point out, too, that we are providing stipends for people living in poverty to participate. We're also providing childcare and providing transportation because, again, their lives are a bit more complex, so they do need some help to ensure that they can be at this table. But I'll tell you, we've had a remarkable response from consumers who are very honored and enthused to be part of this conversation. I think they're going to be great contributors, and absolutely, I couldn't agree with, was it Craig? More. Then they're going to be wonderful.
And Julie from Hector just got a comment from Julie online, almost the exact same comment. She says, how many poor folk are you planning to include at the solution-making level of the task force? Sounds like well-intentioned mainstream people trying to fix problems from the outside.
Not at all. Wait, but I think these aren't the first two people that we've heard this from. I think we need to constantly be aware of this. And we reach out, as Dawn said, to people that have ideas and solutions. We want to formally and informally. We had to start somewhere. The good news is we're just at the beginning of all of this. We need to have people in poverty, people who have these ideas, touching every single part of what we're doing here. We have a long way to go, and let's just start.
All right, well, I want to get to a break here, and we're going to come back. More of your comments that are rolling in here. Questions about policy, how this is going to work. Fran Weisberg and Dawn Borghese from the United Way are here as we talk about the Anti-Poverty Initiative. A lot of great questions on this, and we're going to get as many as we can in over the next 25 minutes or so. So quick break and more with them next on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Wednesday on The Next Connections, our conversation with Nicholas Kristof, longtime New York Times columnist and a globe-trotting journalist who has seen some of the worst conditions, poverty, women's rights, children around the world. What can we do to help them? What would Kristof like to see covered in the upcoming presidential campaign? All of that with Nick Kristof, Wednesday on Connections.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from Doyle Subaru on Ridge Road in Webster, featuring symmetrical all-wheel drive vehicles for all-weather driving, including the 2015 Subaru Legacy. Doyle, serving the Rochester region for more than 70 years. More at doylesubaru.com.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. If you want to join the conversation on Anti-Poverty Initiative, you can call the program 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. And want to get to a couple more of your questions that have just come in the last few minutes. Manny wants to know, what's the timeline for solutions? I keep hearing about coming up with solutions. But when? That's a good question. Do you have a timeline in mind for when you're going to make proposals on changes?
It's pretty aggressive, but we've asked the work groups to have recommendations completed by the end of June.
By the end of June?
Mm-hmm.
By the end of next month?
Might be mid-July, actually. Might go.
But we're talking a couple of months at the most here.
To begin, so
for the work groups
to work groups to give it back to the systems committee, then go to a steering committee. I hear people saying they want it quick and fast. I also don't want this to linger for years. I also don't want something quick, simple, and not thought through. So the work groups will finish their work by mid-July. We'll go to some other places. So by the fall, and we also want to vet it back with,
absolutely,
you know, the community and citizens of this community. And we want it to be a real iterative process. So fall, I don't know.
Okay.
Depends on who you talk to.
Okay.
No, I'm not. Really.
And frankly, as Fran, I think we can't emphasize enough. This is new, really.
Yes.
And so we're building it as we go. So we need to be open to
totally.
Quality and process is important. Inclusiveness is important. So if we have to slow down a little bit to make sure that we have the views of people living in poverty, then we're going to slow down. And then we'll speed up and try to catch up as we can.
But we're not trying to make this a new god darn bureaucracy of Rochester where it's years. We promise.
Okay. Well, and
how about that?
Let me share something with our listeners as well that sometimes what you have when you've got big names, and there are a lot of big names, as we mentioned, involved here. Sometimes what you have are photo ops, and I'm not being overly critical. I'm just observing that occasionally a news conference, somebody comes to town, there's a photo op, you get a picture in a newspaper, and you sort of move on. Let me say that the first time many of the people that I mentioned on that list got together and met and there were work groups, I talked to somebody who's involved, and it was a private conversation. I won't mention their name. But he said to me, I'm used to photo ops. And I thought, coming in, it would be a little bit more of the same. And he said, we walked out of that room, and a lot of people were looking at each other saying, wow, this is a very serious effort, and that this might actually work.
Yay.
I think that there is a realization that sometimes on the outside there's some cynicism about, well, of course, that person involved, or that's a lot of big names. But from what I have heard just talking, having private conversations, there is a seriousness about this issue. My guess is Ed Doherty and the Community Foundation's report has taken away any illusions people have that you can afford to have a photo op. Mm-hmm. That this is the gravity of this. Because of that report, it's become a real
shameful
issue. And Fran mentioned concentration of poverty. If you missed Ed Doherty's report, one of the great findings, the most important findings, was that Rochester not only has extreme poverty at a very high level, children in poverty at a very high level, but a concentration of poverty. And a couple months ago, Ed was on the program and somebody called in and said, hey, you can't tell people where to live. If I want to move to the suburbs to get away from the city and the problems I perceive, and Ed said, oh, but you can, because we told poor people where to live for years. We created this situation where we concentrated the poverty, and now we've got very clustered poverty and housing that has perpetuated the problem. And the question is, how do you start to get out of it? Fran, have you started to think about that problem?
I have, and But because I'm not a housing expert,
sure,
I'm not even going to say it. I mean, there are many, but I will tell you this. Yes, there's these bigwigs or important people that are the steering committee, but there's also some very august people that are co-chairing and on these committees. They are people that are really the co-chairs of Housing are Stuart Mitchell and John Paul Perez. But then there's 23 or 25 other people. There's such a rich diversity of ideas. They have 6 weeks to be trained, to come up with ideas, and then to really go forth with not dreaming. What are those ideas to ensure? I'm just going to throw out an idea that might be politically crazy. How do you make sure there's more low-income housing in the suburbs? You know, how do you change zoning rules? What are the barriers? And please don't quote me on that, because I really do believe in these work group policies. Mm-hmm. But that's what each of them are going to do. And in each of the different work groups, I believe they will work very, very hard to come up with short-term, medium-term, and long-term ideas. I think that's what does make this different. And again, going back to the state, and then we will drive to the Albany and say, okay, what rules are you going to change to help us implement this?
On this subject, I got a very long email from a listener named Bill, and I'm going to try to condense it. Bill says, we need to see suburbs step up and be willing to be part of the solution here. The problem is, as soon as low-income housing shows up in a suburb, whoever the supervisor is will get voted out of office. You will not convince political leaders that they would put their neck on the line for this. Is that too cynical? That's Bill's comment.
Well, I'm going to put myself on the line again. Again, that was just an idea that I had. There are going to be many ideas. Some of them will be very tough and very difficult. Honestly, I don't know what will happen in the community. I am hopeful by having hundreds and hundreds of people that come together. We are really creating a little P and big P political will as a community. This is shameful where we are. I am really asking the entire community to open up your minds. We also do need fundamental change here. So as the head of United Way and as the head of the mayor, the county executive, this is our moment in time. We might have to do some tough, difficult things. Dawn?
No, I would agree. And I think what Fran has emphasized is the diversity of thought.
Yes.
I can tell you we had input sessions at St. John Fisher in December, just before or around the time we were putting together the proposal for the state, the initial thoughts around this project. And I was so taken with the passion, the knowledge, and also the openness people have. I truly believe, I think that it's a fair point, but I don't think it's the only point. And I think in a room together, I just have a great amount of confidence in these work groups that they can really have that kind of back and forth. And I think there's going to have to be more and solutions.
Mm-hmm.
Kate Washington, who works for the city of Rochester, I heard she was part of a conversation very much similar to what was just proposed here. And her response was, but that assumes that people living in the city right now want to live in suburbs, and they not all do. So how do we also uplift and help neighborhoods in this community be the neighborhoods they envision for themselves? That's a fair question, too. And I don't think one negates the other. I think it's how do we potentially go down both pathways in a way that will progress and make the community a better place for all of us.
Kate writes to the program, please tell me that the panel won't stereotype people in poverty. We are not lazy looking for handouts, and it always hurts us to hear that.
Oh,
good
I will
for...
tell you, it is profound, and I will tell you, the one thing that this has done is, I think, is helping us educate people. I will tell you right now, we've had what I call single solution Joes, right? People come and say, you've just got to do X. And one of them is, we just need jobs. And that's true. We absolutely need jobs. But we are going to be focused on the working poor. There's 11,500. The majority of people living in poverty are single women, head of households, working in this community, not and often more than one job, two and three jobs. So I think it is absolutely an opportunity for us to advocate and to help understand how we really put a face on poverty. And many of the people mm-hmm. that we're talking about in theory are people that we work with, that we encounter daily, that we cherish as friends and neighbors and mm-hmm. colleagues.
And we had an all-morning session with folks from Fran Barrett and her team from Albany came to Rochester, and there were these panels. And on each panel, there was somebody living in poverty. some of the most powerful, articulate voices of what their struggle is. I watched people around that room. It was a bunch of bigwigs in the front, but then each there were bigwigs all over the place who stayed 4.5 hours. You could watch people go, huh, and really change their view. We need to do lots and lots and lots of those kinds of sessions.
Mm-hmm. Let me get Sandy in Brighton. Go ahead, Sandy.
Hi. I wanted to call in to comment on something that Fran had said about affordable housing in the suburbs. And I can tell you from firsthand experience, as the supervisor of the town of Brighton for 20 years, we did build affordable housing in the suburbs. We got a little bit of pushback from some folks who said, you know, that's going to bring in, quote, those people, unquote. But the fact is that we built a beautiful neighborhood. We added affordable units to new housing developments for seniors and others, and it worked. It worked well, and we were not voted out of office, mm-hmm. not by a long shot. So it is doable. You have to have the will and the courage and the education to help people understand that having a diverse community enriches.
Sandy, did you get any pushback from residents about that?
We did. We built a neighborhood called Deerfield Woods, and it was so popular that the houses had to be distributed based on a lottery system because there was so much demand. Mm-hmm. And it became a very solid, stable neighborhood, one of many neighborhoods in the community. And with the pushback we got was modest but vocal, but that didn't deter us. We were told, you can't do this or you will be voted out of office. But that isn't what really happened. It isn't what the people believe. They really understood the value of having a diverse community. And mm-hmm. so we were really very pleased with the long-term results.
Sandy Frankel, former supervisor of the town of Brighton. Thank you for the phone call, Sandy. And what do you think, Fran?
No, just I think there are many issues that folks have, so I bet there's other questions.
Okay, well, absolutely. And on the question on policy, a couple of questions mm-hmm. have come in. Manny wrote back, John also writing questions on policy. Manny wants to know if the solutions will include any actual policy recommendations. John wants to know, does the task force have a tax policy committee? He says, I believe the current structure of the earned income tax credit is the biggest barrier to good outcomes for our low-income children. So a lot of very specific ideas on that. Fran?
Actually, that's a very good point. I think there are many cross-cutting kinds of issues that the systems committee and the steering committee will have to look at. One of those is child care. We don't have a child care committee. Okay. We might not have a transportation committee. But there's going to be issues in each one of these, financial issues, financial management. There are many different issues that as we see them, we either form another committee or it goes up to the systems committee. I think there's a lot of cross-cutting issues.
Okay. And very much it will tackle policies. I think that's yes. one of the key differentiators in this. The state has been very clear that they will work in very strong partner with they are as interested in breaking silos and issuing waivers to us. I think they'd like to see us also be used as a demonstration community in some of these instances where we can track and show that by changing this policy, we were able to achieve this. That could be very powerful across the state.
Go ahead, Fran.
Just to look at, we really want to look at a more coordinated set of ideas and solutions for one individual. If Fran needs help, she doesn't have to go to 10 different people. What if there was, again, with Fran in the center of it, with a navigator or a coordinator that helps her get through all of the systems? And if she gets a job and then that knocks her off for $10, knocks her off getting child care or WIC or another program that could help her. Let's be more rational in our system and look at a holistic, integrated, coordinated approach. That's a lot of the policy issues we're also trying to look at.
Okay. Before I get to Bob in Rochester on the phones next, one more follow-up question to that. I think you have political leaders. You have Joe Morelli. I'm sure you're going to be pulling in a lot of different political leaders, and you already have for this. Mm-hmm. But I almost, how do I describe this? If I were a state senator, no matter what party I was in, and you and I saw the breadth of the work that you were doing with the Anti-Poverty Initiative, as Fran and Dawn have said this hour, bringing in subject matter experts across the spectrum, working really at an accelerated timetable maybe, but in depth on very difficult problems, I would be willing to say, look, whatever you come out and decide and you ask for, I'm willing to try. I don't care what my party says. Because this is a nonpartisan group, I will sign on to say, I will have a timetable to see if things are working. But if you tell me we need to do X, okay. If you tell me we need a minimum wage increase, or if you tell me we should eliminate the minimum wage, if you tell me we should have affordable housing here, I'll sign on because we have to try something. I just don't know that you're going to get political leaders who eventually say, yes, we'll do that.
I love what you just described, and if we do our job right, that's exactly where we have to go. By the end of this multi-stakeholder group that we have gotten a true consensus, I am hopeful that these political leaders will say, wow, this community worked incredibly hard, had hundreds of people from all walks of life come up with these decisions. I'll be darned if they shouldn't say what you just say and say, yep, we're going to go on this, but that's what our job is. That's what my job is. That's what these other leaders on this steering committee should be striving for, what you just said.
Tall mountain to climb. We
it
shall
is,
see.
I believe in our community.
Bob in Rochester. Go ahead, Bob.
I want to know how United Way is going to change. And let me give you one example. United Way of Rochester has the second largest endowment of any United Way in the whole United States. And not all United Ways have endowment. Last I heard, the endowment was $115 million. And $7 million or so is unrestricted. And yet, according to the press, United Way is going to use up to $250,000 of the state money made available to hire staff for the Anti-Poverty Initiative, support and all of that. So how is United Way going to change sitting on that kind of prosperity in the midst of concentrated poverty?
Bob, because we only have a couple of minutes, let me ask our guests to go ahead and respond. Thanks for the call, Bob. Dawn?
I think Fran's gonna...
You're right. United Way is investing a great deal of funds into this because as the convener, we do believe our staff and our real dollars are going into providing the infrastructure. We just can't and don't want to do it alone, that it's the foundations, United Way, and government coming together to provide some of the seed money. And I am hopeful we will also put, as we come up with solutions, you're right, United Way should be part of that. We're investing millions of dollars a year in attacking poverty, and we will try to even do more. Dawn?
And I would just say that, we're thrilled to have Fran as our new leader at United Way, and I know that one of the things that brought her to us is her ability to really reach out and talk to a variety of people in the community. And frankly, we're at United Way, we know we need to change the way we do business, and I think Fran is very excited to be with us to help lead that charge and figure out how we do operate differently. So I don't think we hold ourselves out as unique in having to make changes, and I'm sure that you'll see we will be making changes.
As we begin to wrap up the conversation with Fran Weisberg and Dawn Borghese from the United Way talking about this anti-poverty initiative, I wonder, Fran, when you say it's part of your job to convince the policymakers to get on board.
Yes.
And you want to make this apolitical as possible.
Yes.
But eventually, will you make it a political loser if they won't get on board with the policy changes?
I don't think this is politics. This is about the community. Again, when I have done this before, whether it's talking about aging issues or how we totally change the way we do things to create health improvement in a community or other issues, I believe that people want to do the right thing. If we have a process with integrity and honor and everybody's come together, I believe in our community leaders, whether it's political leaders or business leaders or other leaders, that we have to do this, and we will.
Is there a sense after reading the report from Ed Doherty and the Community Foundation, looking at other cities, we look inward to our problems. Do you look to other places that maybe have lower rates of poverty? Do you try to study what has worked?
Yes, we are doing that every day. In fact, there are other communities that are models that have done this, that have come together collectively as a community and said, we can't do it anymore the way we have done it before. Bring everybody together. And I think there are gutsy, good leaders in other places. We are looking to them, and I'm hopeful that we can do it. But I also want us to lead. I also think we have some unique challenges and unique abilities that we might be able to do it. I think there's a lot of interest. So yes, both ways.
The last comment I would make is I was just on WXXINews.org and saw the headline, New Study Looks at Problems Local Children Face When They Try to Rise Out of Poverty. And so many times, children are the victims. Mm-hmm. Children grow up in poverty. Even when they try to move forward, it can be difficult. I'm not saying it's impossible, and I hope nobody hears this and thinks, oh, he's saying that, you know, systemic poverty prevents anyone from having a real chance. But I hope for everyone's sake, but really for the sake of kids, as the father of a three-year-old now, I look at how fortunate my son is, and I want him to know it. But I really hope that what you're doing works, because I think about kids, all the times I've been at the Hall of Justice reporting on stories over years, and I see little toddlers walking through, and I think, I don't know where this is heading.
Yeah.
But I think about kids, and I suspect you both do as well.
And I hope that I believe we'll be successful if we can keep that at the forefront, that this really is about kids and families. We can look at data, and data is important, but at the end of the day, the story really is in the eyes of the children, that we should be able to look at them with great pride and say, we did this because you deserve the future that we want for all of our kids, not just for a special few.
So first of what I hope will be many conversations on the Anti-Poverty Initiative on this program with many of the stakeholders. And I know this community will hold that group accountable, and I think the group will hold the political leaders accountable, and we'll see what comes out of it. Dawn and Fran from the United Way, thank you both for updating us.
Thank you.
And their third simulation of poverty is this Friday afternoon. That will be an interesting day and much more to learn going forward. Thanks for listening to both hours this afternoon. I'm Evan Dawson, and this is Member-Supported Public Radio.